You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 642, Glastonbury gives up on rock bands, the unstoppable rise of Emma Barnett, The Hive's new business model, and farewell to Steve Harley. That's all coming up after Love Affair and Everlasting Love.
Hearts on a string, keeping her when they go. I went away just when you need me so. You won't regret, I've come back begging you. Won't you forget, welcome love we once knew. Open up your eyes, then you realize, here I stand with my everlasting love. Need you by my side, girl, to be my bride. You'll never be denied, everlasting love. From the very start, open up your heart, feel that you fall, everlasting love.
From my top 10 of all time, from one of the most underrated of bands. Singer Steve Ellis was 17. Drummer Maurice Bacon was 16. All of them were teenagers. Very short run of success. Five singles in 18 months. All of them top 20 between 1967 and 1969. Also, this track features Kiki Dee, Madeline Bell and Leslie Duncan on backing vocals. Number one in the UK in February 1968, Love Affair and Everlasting Love.
I mean, an all-timer, I completely agree with you. I've played that at so many weddings, Terence. I cannot tell you how many weddings I've played that. It's always a floor filler. And usually, I like to play that after the first dance that I've been requested to play. This is usually one that everybody then sort of throngs onto the dance floor to join in. It's a real feel-good song, and it's really multi-generational. Also featured to great effect in the film Belfast that was directed by Ken Branagh. A lovely film. If you've not seen it, it's worth seeing. Entirely in black and white, and sort of based heavily on his childhood. And Jamie Dornan plays his sort of dad in it, and he sings that on stage with a band, and he's really good. I was really surprised at what a good singer he was. So greatly used in that film. But yeah, what a great song. I completely agree.
The Love Affair were the top UK group in terms of sales in 1968 in the UK, excepting the Beatles.
Indeed, and yet almost completely forgotten now. Like you say, they were huge for a very short period of time, or a relatively short period of time. And I don't think I could name you any singles other than that. And that song has endured. The Cast of Casualty, I believe, had a hit with it some years ago. I think so, yes, and an attempt to launch somebody's solo career, I think. But yeah, Rebecca Wheatley, I want to say, I don't know. Anyway, a really great song. But yeah, like you say, such a forgotten act.
Well, I'll tell you, how much do I love this band? I'll tell you.
Did I
get a tattoo of their name on my leg? No, I'm an adult. What I did do
apologies to all of our listeners that have tattoos. It's not aimed at you.
Oh dear. I tracked down each of the original members of the band, and each one of them is a friend on Facebook.
Oh,
and I
really?
Couldn't be prouder to be able to say
oh,
that.
Wow.
Rex Brayley, Maurice Bacon, Steve Ellis, Linton Guest, Morgan Fisher all went their separate ways 55 years ago, but I've brought them together on my Facebook friends lineup.
Oh, wow. I can see this spinning on now. Are you going to be the man that reunites the love affair for some sort of tentpole gig, like my 40th possibly later this year? Who knows? Maybe
who
that's
knows?
What we've got to do.
Could happen. Welcome to the Parish Council. It's episode 643. I'm Terence Stackham. And this week, a used lipstick belonging to Marilyn Monroe raised $65,000 at auction.
Goodness me.
How much then for any lipstick eyeshadow belonging to Juliet Harris, I wonder?
Well,
millions of pounds, I would suggest.
I mean, nothing, because I never use the stuff. So not a perfect comparison, slightly. Although if anybody wants a used tea bag from me, you're welcome. I mean, it's available to the highest bidder, obviously. You do wonder how some people are living their lives, don't you, really? When, you know, particularly, I mean, you know, without getting beat for a minute, because we try not to get downbeat on this podcast. You know, when the cost of living crisis that is sort of gripping the UK at the moment, people even on pretty good salaries struggling to live, stuff like that just becomes, it almost offends me now. It shouldn't, because I know that, you know, obviously if people are entitled to spend their money as they wish, if you have lots of disposable income, blah 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 blah, etc. But yeah, in this day and age, you know, that news like that, it enrages me, Sir Terence, and I really don't think of myself as a class war warrior. But anyway, it's difficult news to swallow in the world in which we live, particularly here in the UK. So who knows? Maybe I'll let you have my used tea bag for free. Maybe that's the answer to that. Anyway, yeah. Good day to you all.
I think if I was even a billionaire, Jules, I don't think I'd spend $65,000 on a lipstick. It would depend on the shade, of course. You know, I'd have to sort of, and what I was wearing on that day. But,
yes, absolutely true. And although if it had belonged to Paul McCartney, then obviously we would both pay five times that money. But still.
Indeed. Now, the lineup for Glastonbury 2024 has been announced. The headliners are Dua Lipa, Czar, and Coldplay, of course. And the Sunday Legend slot is filled by Shania Twain. That they were never going to get Taylor or Madonna or Billy Joel. So that lineup seems to reflect where we are in music, or does it? Because no sooner had that lineup been released than The Telegraph's music writer Neil McCormack starts hammering away at his keyboard. Here's a quote. The Glastonbury headline bill looks a bit less vintage jukebox and more like the excitable soundtrack to a children's birthday party. And here's his description of Coldplay. There's one little bit in this that I do really like, I must say. But
Go on.
He describes Coldplay bouncing onto the stage like the labradoodles of rock. I like that. Sure to cheer up even the most sceptical with their gormless, effervescent joy. This is all rather harsh, Jules, isn't it?
I feel it is rather. Also, first point of order, I believe her name is pronounced Caesar. But
Caesar, what did I say? Czar.
Czar, I think. I mean, to be fair,
I mean, it's your world, not mine.
I know. The issue is not yours, Sir T. Heal. Having said that, just as a side bar to that, this was explained to me by a person even younger than me, who is a writer in the music industry a while ago. The reason why these young people have these funny names, just to hammer home me sounding 112, is that they used to evade search engines on the internet. They're for search engine optimization purposes, hence by the band Churches spell their name with a V instead of a U.
I see. It's all SEO.
Yeah.
Search engine optimization.
Which is a depressing point more than anyone can say. But anyway, yes. So yes, I agree. I mean, although having said that, you know, people say, oh, Glastonbury is away from its roots. I think the Glastonbury roots have always been to reflect popular or well-liked music of the day. And so you could argue, well, Glastonbury has ended up with the headliners that it's got because these are the people that are having the most success. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the Glastonbury bill as well, the idea it's a kid's birthday party. If you look at the next line down from the headliners, you've got LCD Sound System, Little Sims, Burna Boy and PJ Harvey. You've got two Mercury Music Prize winners there out of four, which I really don't think is a bad sort of thing. Burna Boy, all successful in different ways. The next line down from that is you've got Cyndi Lauper, Michael Kiwanuka, Janelle Monáe, and 17. So you've got a real... And then below that, you've got Paul Heaton, Paloma Faith, Keane. So you've got all... And then the other stage has got Idols headlining. You've got all sorts of different... different things. Glastonbury is all about the different stages. It's about the whole experience rather than the headliners. And I think that's rather short-sighted to think that Glastonbury is about the bands that headline it. I mean, if I keep scanning down this bill. The West Holt stage has got Jessie Ware on it, who is fantastic. You know, you've got Sleeper Mods elsewhere. You've got all sorts of people performing. Glastonbury is a multifaceted beast. It's grown and grown and grown. And you can make arguments about whether or not Glastonbury left its roots the minute it put a fence up, for example. But then it put a fence up because it was coming an incredibly dangerous place to go. People were getting shot and killed in the late 90s. It had become really out of control and was needed to be safe. And, you know, it's all very well, you know, critics in ivory towers saying, oh, it's not the same as it used to be. It's got away from its roots. Yeah, you try getting dysentery from mud and then getting shot at and see how you feel about it after that. I mean, obviously, some of these acts are not... I mean, I think that they're excellent in their own right. I was more depressed by the fact that Shania Twain is doing the Legends slot, because that makes me feel very, very old.
Yes, it does seem a bit early in her career.
I mean, it does, but having said that, I hate to inform you that the album Come On Over is more than 25 years old.
Wow.
So is it too soon in her career?
I withdraw that.
I know, it's terrifying, isn't it, really? And I think as well, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, but this is a point I'm going to make again. When you talk about, oh, there aren't these headliners, blah, 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 this is not helped. This is why I was arguing 6-7 years ago that we will eventually pay the price and see the end result of small music venues closing across the country. Those places were the lifeblood of rock acts. And yes, I know that the music industry works quite differently now in lots of ways, and that you've got sort of bedroom recording going on, but that has resulted, and the TikTok generation has resulted in quite a lot of solo laptop artists rather than necessarily what our friend at the Telegraph would call the great rock band. So this is merely reflecting where music is now, I would say, rather than necessarily where music was when we were living in a world, a pre-COVID world, of, you know, the great rock band. It you know, it says a lot that Coldplay is still headlining. Coldplay have headlined a lot because they're still really, really good. If Radiohead wanted to headline, I suspect they would. It's a shame that they couldn't get a Madonna or a Taylor Swift. That genuinely would have been fantastic. And actually, I think it says a lot about Beyonce retrospectively that she agreed to headline and was absolutely fabulous. She was so good that it makes me like her a lot more, I must say, even though I liked her a lot already, because it was her that sort of took that risk and did it. So some of these acts will be excellent, I'm sure. Everyone that will go will have a fantastic time. I think the most surprising thing, Avril Lavigne on the other stage, three lines down, sort of struck me by surprise, given how big she was at one point. But anyway, and I bet she'll have a great one. And she might be, you know, you never know who's going to be the surprise breakout star of Glastonbury. Who would have put money on Rick Astley being the voice of Glastonbury last year, which he very much was, having the time of his life with Blossoms doing the Smith stuff? It's a great festival. It will remain a great festival. It's evolved over time. Of course it has. It's evolved over time to match how music is evolving over time. I wish some rock critics could do the same, Sir Terence.
Well, meanwhile, if Glastonbury 24 doesn't do it for you, like Neil McCormick, we all of us need to go to Hollywood Park in Los Angeles August the 31st and the Fall in Love One Day Festival. $275 for general admission, but wait for this. Top of the bill, some people would compare this to Glastonbury, and let's see what you think. Mm. Top of the bill, Lionel Richie and Diana Ross. Then you've got Nile Rodgers and Chic, Al Green, Santana, Gladys Knight, the Isley Brothers, Chaka Khan, Dionne Warwick, Smokey Robinson, Jules, the list goes on and on. I mean, surely the organisers are going to go bust.
Well, I mean, you do wonder, do you? Although you must think, surely this is going to sell out. This is also the day before my 40th birthday. birthday, by the way, so I am starting to seriously consider whether I just want to escape and go and do this. I mean, this is incredible, isn't it?
I'm seriously tempted, Jules. I really am.
Me too. Although having said that, I mean, this lineup is just incredible. But there are a lot of names for one day, aren't there? How many people? How long are these acts doing? Because I'm trying to look to see how many acts there are on this bill. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. I mean, I reckon we've probably got about 50 acts on this page. How long is all day? Are we starting at dawn and ending at dusk, or are we doing even longer than that? I'm a little bit worried, said T, that we'd be flying all the way over there and we'll get 2.5 songs from Al Green and we'll get 2.5 songs from Santana. I mean, it's brilliant. But I remember when I did GCSE media studies. Yes, stop laughing at the back. I had a lovely time. It was very interesting. And actually, I wouldn't be doing this podcast without it, I don't think. It really sort of encouraged my interest in the media. And it wasn't just, you know, sticking things on things. And we did a lot of interesting kind of stuff. I remember us doing, trying to design film posters and talking about films. And I remember trying to absolutely front load my film with all kinds of stars. I remember my media studies teacher saying at the time, oh, you know, you can't go too wild with this. It's all right having an ensemble cast of somebody like Trainspotting, because people only really knew one or two of those stars. He said, if you overload your film with all sorts of stars, people won't quite know who to watch. And I think to some extent, I realised years later that I was effectively trying to do Ocean's 11. So maybe I wasn't entirely at fault. But I think there's something to be said here for, I mean, the top three rungs of this would headline any other festival. Chaka Khan would headline a Hyde Park festival over here. Nile Rodgers and Sheik have done Glastonbury before, and on the Friday night, I think they played. So I do worry that it might all be a bit too much for tea, and you might only get sort of three songs. And also, there is always the worry as well: are these people any good anymore, Sir T? Tales of Chuck Berry and your work on him at the end of his career, which was all pretty grim. And also, you know, are these people any good? And also, are these the people that we think they are? How many of the original gang are in Cool and the Gang? This is like Boney M. Boney M played here a few years ago, and someone said to me, which one of Boney M is it, do you think, that's playing at the White Rock? Which one of Shalimar are we seeing today? Yes. There is always the worry that you're seeing, you know, some sort. Yes, Smokey Robinson is Smokey Robinson. I take that point. There's also all the Delphonics are playing as well. I've just noticed.
No, every time incredible. I read
a different name, sort of
Rose Royce, the Stylistics,
Los Lobos, who I presume will do La Bamba and two other songs. But I love the sound of this, Sir T. It's everyone you ever wanted to see. I just am worried. A, how much are we going to see of them? I went to see, I think listeners will remember, I went to see Motown the musical, the official musical, a few years ago. My mum took me for my birthday, and it was sanctioned by Berry Gordy, so it was Berry Gordy's tale. But we were struck by the fact, I think we talked on the podcast about the rather officious notice banning people from singing along.
Oh, yes.
But the other memory of it that I had was that we really enjoyed it, but it was very much a sort of a jukebox-style musical, and it said it had 50 Motown songs in it, which it did. However, we only heard about 7 in full. I mean, luckily, some of the ones we heard in full were great. We have, you know, Ball of Confusion and You All I Need to Get By, I'm Still Waiting. We had some fantastic songs, but it was occasionally a bit frustrating where they would strike up into, I don't know, Get Ready, Because Here I Come. You'd think, oh, I love this. And then they'd segue into something. And you think, oh, damn it, I really needed more than 40 seconds of that. And I'm a bit worried that that will happen here. And also, B, you know, we're not seeing this in 1972, Sir T. And I worry that perhaps we should have seen this then.
Yes. Well, I can...
Sorry to be negative.
That's fine. You make some very good points there. I do see that there are multiple stages. And reflecting perhaps the age of the attendees, if you take out a VIP package, you get golf carts to ferry between various stages. So if you think, oh, God, Smokey Robinson's on at the other stage in 2 minutes,
exactly.
You get into a golf cart and you're whizzed over there in time.
Absolutely. So if you do want to see, I mean, just every time I look at this, if you do want to see the Barclays and then you want to zip over and see Dionne Warwick, you'd like to pop back to see the Pointer Sisters. Really don't understand why they're so low down, but anyway, it's I just can't get over how many names there are on this. Maybe too many, I don't know. I hope that there are sufficient golf cart routes. I hope this has been mapped out. I'm now starting to panic of golf cart crashes everywhere. As people are desperate to go and see the Delphonics and catch Eric Burdon and the Animals. I really hope that it's well organised, the tea, because it could be pretty carnagey if not. Because how on earth do you manage the mechanics of everyone wanting to see all those bands at the same moment?
Larry David could write an entire season out of what the portrayal you've just given us of the golf cart mayhem. This is really genuine. If you really want to look it up, it's not an April Fool. It's August 31st, Hollywood Park, Los Angeles, $275, and. You never know. We might all meet up there.
Who knows?
I hope it isn't another potential fire festival.
Yeah,
because it looks too good to be true.
That's my only concern. Well, yes. I mean, the fact that you can buy hotel and ticket packages are from $750. That seems pretty good to me. The word from may be doing some heavy lifting there.
Coming next, the rise and rise of Emma Barnett and the Hives save the music business. That's next, right after Kate Le Bon.
I really like Kate Le Bon. I think she's incredibly underrated as far as acts go. She just quietly gets on with doing interesting projects and releasing fantastic records. She's only 41, released, yet again, I need to get on with this, Seti, released 6 solo studio albums to date and is one half of the experimental music duo Drinks, stylized in all capitals if you're looking those up, who I used to hear on Late Junction on Radio 3. Very interesting artist. Like I say, several sort of albums that she's released, all of which are excellent. I think they're all worth listening to. But that was taken from the album Mug Museum, which is probably my favourite, that was released in 2013, and that was Sisters.
I'm delighted to read that the album Mug Museum is a reference coined by her roommate and refers to the number of teacups accumulated in Kate Le Bon's bedroom. I mean, I'd be saying, for God's sake, put them in the dishwasher.
I know. But I must say that, you know, maybe that's why this album speaks to me as well, because I'm not averse to a mug museum myself occasionally.
From A Most Unusual Childhood, the career of the British broadcaster Emma Barnett has been hurtling upwards since her first radio appearances on LBC from 2011, when she was 26. Since then, BBC Five Live, presenting the weekday morning show, then BBC Two's Newsnight on television, and Woman's Hour on Radio 4, where her interviewing skills were sometimes criticised for being rather confrontational. This month, Emma Barnett steps away from Women's Hour and joins the morning news, the Today programme, as a presenter. Jules, some will see this as the BBC moving the deck chairs around as they continue to try and attract a younger audience, but there's no denying the ongoing rise of Emma Barnett.
I mean, she is literally irresistible, isn't she? That is how I would describe her. There's some fantastic quotes about her in this in this BBC article, which suggests that what's that phrase that my mum used to use about toddlers to their parents, when you don't quite want to slag off someone else's child yet you want to acknowledge their behavior, go, well, yeah, she's a handful. And I sense that Emma Barnett might be a handful for good and ill. Deborah Turner, CEO of BBC News, says, Emma is a formidable, fearless and ferociously intelligent journalist. Yes, ooh, that's someone who is cracking, but also cracking, if you see what I mean. She also adds, Emma will bring her unique energy and verve. I'm often someone that is described as having a unique energy.
I couldn't believe
I'm not sure it's always a compliment, Seti, but anyway, she's also described by the controller of Radio 4, Mahit Bakaya, as a tenacious journalist who's brought her distinctive and forensic interview style to Women's Hour. Yes, I've enjoyed her time on Women's Hour. Having said this, because I think it was an institution that slightly, as much as I like the previous presenters, she decodified aspects of it. And I think that was really, I really admired her for that. I thought that was really cool. Having said that, Today really does seem a perfect fit for her. I was talking with some friends about her the other day, about her time on Newsnight when she used to appear semi-regularly on that. And they said that they thought she was absolutely fantastic, but they sensed occasionally that she was sort of overly transparent in her desire to ambitiously get a story as a young journalist. Yes. I don't know if that is fair or not. But then having said that, ambition is always treated more harshly in women than it is in men. So actually, I have a lot of time for Emma Barnett. Like you say, very difficult childhood and sort of early adulthood. Father ended up going to prison. And she said that that was the moment at which she decided she was going to really, really go for it. And, you know, I think it says huge amounts of things, fantastic things about her strength, personality and character, that she was to do that. I think that it's a good sign of in a political interviewer, and we need scrutiny in our age more than ever at the moment. We seem to be blessed, quote unquote, with politicians that need to be scrutinized more than at any other point in time, and we need people with the skills to do that. And I don't think anybody is better equipped than Emma Barnett, simply because if you ask somebody the question, would you like to be interviewed by Emma Barnett, if they say no, which I think 99% of people would say, no, I don't want to be interviewed by Emma Barnett, thank you, that's a good sign, isn't it? If you don't want to be interviewed by someone, it's because you suspect that they're going to find you out. And actually, that's what makes her so good. And people like that who are able to get to the heart of matter on things might not always be the easiest people to be around, but Do we need them to be easy to be around? No. Do we need them to be scrutinising? Yeah, we do, actually. So all power to Emma Barnett. And I'm looking forward to my Radio 4 tuned alarm clock waking me up in the morning to her. And also, and I'm having to do a complete vault facility, Amal Rajan is an increasingly talented interviewer on that. And I wasn't a fan for some time. But, do you know, I think we need people to challenge the people in power more than ever. So whilst I enjoyed Emma Barnett bringing a serious news agenda to Women's Hour, let's see how she gets on at Today. Well, I suspect.
Well, as you say, Emma Barnett has to date been noted for being rather outspoken. And I hope the Today programme doesn't try and rein her in. At the moment, the BBC seems terrified of people taking offence and they appear to be trying to be all things to all people. But I personally prefer it when presenters have a point of view which can be challenged rather than forever saying this and this, but on the other hand, that and that. And
yeah.
Just because someone on your show has said that the earth is round, you're not obliged to invite on someone who will argue the earth is flat. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So
let Emma be Emma. Yeah, exactly. I completely agree. BBC Balance often shoots itself in the foot multiple times. And I agree. And actually, like you say, let Emma be Emma. I suspect that Emma Barnett is fly enough that she wouldn't have agreed to anything with restrictions. So so let's see. Let's see what happens. But there will be fireworks, but I hope they're allowed to go off.
Now, we know it's hard in this age for performers to make a living through music. Recordings don't carry the same profit margins they once did. And the opportunities for live performances, as you pointed out before, diminishing. But for one band, the demand for live shows is such that they've come up with an unusual solution, Jules.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had to say, if you had to predict to me which band that was on the circuit would come up with this, I would have probably predicted the always faintly ridiculous yet somehow excellent The Hives, fronted by the self-styled Howlin' Pelle Almqvist. They come from Sweden originally, and there's some fantastic names. I don't believe these are these people's real names, but Nikolaus Arson, Vigilante Kallström, Dr. Matt Destruction and Chris Dangerous. Unfortunately, Matt Destruction had to retire in 2013 for health reasons, I hope Matt as well, and was replaced by someone called Johan, starred as the Johan and Only. Very good. Johan and Only. So yes, always quite an interesting bunch of people. Like many people, I was first introduced to them in 2001 by their brilliantly titled sort of introductory compilation called Your New Favourite Band. And they very much were my new favourite band and my neighbour at university. There was one particular day where one of us played the album in full and then the other one played the album in full, and our other remaining housemates made a petition to get us to stop. But huge fan of this band. That was released on Alan McGee's Pop Tones record label, which turned out to be rather ill-fated, although the Queen had shares in it memorably. But so the Hives, if you wanted to sum the Hives up, and they're kind of, they're not exactly shrinking to violet city. The closing track on that compilation was called The Hives Are Law, You Are Crime. So they've always been quite sure of themselves, I would say. By the way, that 12-track compilation coming in at 28 minutes and 8 seconds. So I would very much recommend that as a blast. So they've decided, in their infinite wisdom, and I think it is very interesting and ridiculous and kind of is very them, they shared a statement last year encouraging fans to sign up to put on their own tribute shows and uncover rewards. The Hives franchise needs you, they began inevitably in block capitals. We have arrived at a point where the Hives can no longer keep up with public demands for concerts. They continued, this is where you come in. Help us create a world where the Hives are playing in every city all the time. Let's make business together and rock and roll. Sign up now and register your interest. Many rewards wait in store. We have spoken. I might have to end all my emails. I have spoken now, Sir Terence. That is an excellent way. So they have now launched the venues of their first, wait for it, Sir Terence, franchise shows. Do you get it? Like a franchise, but franchise. They've just describe themselves as prepare for this Hives But Other People fantasticness. I love that idea of a band but other people. Are those attending our shows in Nottingham, Brighton and Manchester, you, the public, thank you for addressing me with my full name, the Hives, have come forth to pay pre and post Hives shows as start of what will surely be a worldwide eternally successful business model. I mean, I'm living for the statement from the Hives. They clearly know that they're ridiculous. And anybody that is in possession of their own absurdity is always greatly admired by me. Apparently, the Hives also noted that the band will not be playing at these shows. They will only be playing their normal shows, which are currently sold out. So basically, what they're saying is that if the Hives have sold out a show, if you still want to see the Hives, then you can go and see the next best thing, which is the franchise. This band are called the Main Offenders, presumably taking their name from the Hive single Main Offender. So is this going to work? Is this not going to work? I don't know. The following two gigs. So we've missed them, I think. Well, there's one on tonight. So we missed them in Brighton earlier on in the week. But the Main Offenders are at Manchester's Disorder this evening when we record Saturday, April 6th. The Five Hives, the Hive of Fives playing at Brighton and the Beehives in Manchester, free of charge to Terence. Worth popping down. Mm. I would see a Hives tribute band for free. Most people would, I'm sure. I mean, obviously, I'd rather see Howling Pele. But, I'm so intrigued by this story, which is, of course, a massive publicity stunt. But it's done with such panache in the way that most of the Hives' public communications and public image is. Is this a bad idea? I don't know. It's a lot of fun, though. I can't help but be charmed by it, Sati.
Well, I mean, there are certain franchises that seem like a license to print money and almost impossible to fail. I mean, once a McDonald's opens, they seem to be rooted in that location forever. Whether the Hives rock band have enough charm and longevity to suit a franchise remains to be seen. But, I mean, it is certainly an innovative idea, and we must wait and see if we're all tempted to go and see licensed mini-me versions of Fleetwood Mac or Queen or Led Zeppelin. I mean, next it'll all be AI and holograms like ABBA.
Oh, yes. I'd rather this than that. And also, the point is worth making. Don't forget that the tribute band industry is huge in this country. Yeah. And actually, a lot of regional theatres really rely on tribute bands. And actually, they're enduringly popular because a lot of people that will never get to see Fleetwood Mac would like to see a Fleetwood Mac tribute band. Me and my dad went through a phase of taking it in turns on a rota to take my mum to see various tribute bands. I will never forgive my dad for getting T-Rexity. I really wanted to see them. But anyway, mum did not want to see No Oasis, the Oasis tribute band, sadly, although her friend Donna did go to see one called Fake That, who sounded excellent. But actually, maybe those bands are successful. And this is going to sound like a real diss on the Hives now. I don't want it to. Tribute bands are successful because either A, that band is dead and you cannot see them anymore. Or B, that band is massively, massively successful. Like Adele, for example. I had a friend that made a good living drumming for an Adele tribute act for a couple of years. and you know, if you can't afford to go to Las Vegas to see Adele, as we've discussed previously on the podcast, maybe you can go and see the next best thing instead and enjoy her music. Maybe you can enjoy the music of artists without the artist. That is what the tribute band industry is sort of pegged on. The Hives are still very much with us. And also, yes, the Hives have sold out shows. I regret to inform you, Terence, that these are not Wembley Arena-sized shows. These are, they're playing the Brighton Dome, but you know, they're not playing venues of more than 1,500, I would say. So this is not quite the same thing as wanting to see an Adele tribute because you can't get tickets for Wembley. But I do wish them well.
Oh, absolutely, and so do I. Now, there's more to come, including a farewell to Steve Harley and a look at ticket prices as a ratio of the weekly wage.
This is going to hurt, I think.
Stay with us. That's after Duran Jones and the Indications. It's wrong. They say my child. It was one of our listeners several years ago now that pointed me in the direction of this band, and I've followed their fortunes ever since. This track is from their debut and is sung exquisitely by their drummer, Aaron Fraser. Mm. Duran Jones and the Indications, Is It Any Wonder?
A brilliant band, and also one of the many artists appearing at the Fall in Love Festival. Maybe worth going just for them. I'm a big fan of them. I think they're such a great modern soul tradition band. I love hearing them. After the very sad loss of Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, they feel like one of the only games in town at the moment for sort of classic soul revival. So I really like them.
Mm. Now, it's peculiar how when I've reached this age, I'm often unable to remember what I did last Monday, but I can recall with absolute clarity incidents from 50 years ago.
Brilliant.
And I remember so vividly listening to Tony Blackburn on Radio 1 in the late summer of 1973. And he'd recently taken over the mid-morning slot. It was a time when most of the records on Radio 1 were selected by the producer. And clearly, Tony had not previously heard the record he introduced. He played Sebastian, the first single from Cockney Rebel. And I remember that after about maximum of about a minute, he took it off the turntable, berated the choice for his show, and assured us we wouldn't have to hear any more of it. So it wasn't the most encouraging start for the career of Steve Harvey and Cockney Rebel. Fast forward 6 months from that and into 1974, and I had my first job in the music business, cold calling social secretaries at universities, colleges, halls, bars, and booking out bands and artists on tours. Mm-hmm. And the two bands first given to me, very small-time bands to sell to colleges, were Queen and Cockney Rebel. And I remember very well, it was £175 each for them, if you wanted to put them on at your university. And at the time, Cockney Rebel were the easier to place. And the other memory I have is getting praised, because I remember getting them an extra £25 for a trip to a festival in Holland. And I was given a pat on the back for stretching the organisers of the festival to an extra £25. So then Jules, Steve Harley, he broke up the band and wrote Make Me Smile.
And therefore, I presume, didn't have to do very much in his life ever again. It was one of those. Well, and I mean that, you know, with great respect.
No, sometimes people
really just. My view is, you deserve to live off one hit for the rest of your life if that one hit is really, really good. In the same way as Noddy Holder only working for 3 weeks a year because of the Christmas song. Yeah. As brilliantly portrayed, by the way, in the film About a Boy, starring Hugh Grant, where he's the main character in it. Lives this kind of weirdly itinerant life drifting along because his father wrote a world famous Christmas song and therefore he doesn't need to do anything else. The idea that the poor old Jerry Rafferty, his addiction problems not helped by the fact that he was getting an annual income from Baker Street of $70,000 a year just through radio play. Come up and see me. One of those songs that one is always delighted to hear on the radio. I'll always turn it up if I'm driving somewhere and it comes on. And you know, you do hear it reasonably regularly, I think. It was used to great effect in, was it the Full Monty, I think it was used in. It was used in one of those really big 90s films. And it's just so effervescent, the way that it chugs along, the way that Steve's vocal on it is so idiosyncratic that when you sing it like he does, because he's just got such an interesting kind of intonation. An accent. You
it's
can't
only
sing it
metal.
In your own voice. Yes, exactly.
Such a bore.
But he sings. Isn't it weird how it's not necessarily that unique in that he sings It was almost Virginia Plain by Roxy Music, isn't it, his accent? It's almost David Bowie as well, and very much of that era. Although him and Cockney Rebel, they never quite achieved the fame of either, did they really? And it just proves to me that, you know, it's a mixture of talent and luck, isn't it, that gets you along the entertainment game. And you do think, oh, with a couple of other really strong songs, where would they have gone? But if you are going to be a largely one-hit wonder, have a fantastic hit like that. What a tune. Although you may go on to tell me that they have more success than I've realised. But
they did have several other hit singles, Judy Teen, Mr. Soft. But you're right. Nothing as spectacularly successful as Make Me Smile. I haven't checked, but I'm sure it was reissued, excuse me, 4 or 5 times over the years, and I think on most times at least scraped into the chart, usually I think based on the fact that it had been linked to a movie or an advert or something.
Yes, it was in the Full Monty, apparently.
Yeah, made reappearances. You're very right there. I mean, it was quite a brave move to split up the band so early.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it was always, at least from Steve Harley's perspective, his band and some supporting musicians, and I think the people that came in afterwards, like Jim Cregan on guitar, understood that that was the way it was going to be.
Absolutely. If you want the actual stats on this, by the way, I've just got them up. So number one in the UK singles chart in 1975. It got to 96 on the US Billboard Hot 100 in 76, and then it was released in 92 over here in the UK and got to 46. Released in 95 and got to 33. Doesn't look like they did release it off the back of the Full Monty, which seems a bit strange to me. But anyway, it was re-released in 2005, got to 55, and then re-released in 2015, got to 72. And actually, upon his death, it reached number 13 in the UK singles downloads chart, and then number 16 in the UK singles sales chart. So it's like you say, it kept sort of coming back. Various cover versions. The Wedding Present did a version as part of their covers sort of project. Duran Duran, Erasure, Susie Quattro, all sorts of people. But like you say, very interesting that Steve Harley's favourite was The Wedding Present, by the way. And it has sold and sold. I suspect this following the reissue, this will be out of date now. But as of 2015, it had sold over 1.5 million copies worldwide, one of the most played songs in British broadcasting history. It was produced by Alan Parsons along with Steve Harley, the kind of soft rock king. It got a gold certificate from the British phonographic industry in October 2021. And I suspect, who knows, the sales recently might have pushed that up a bit more, I think. But yeah, I didn't realise Mr. Soft was them. That was on a Trebor soft mint advert when I was growing up, which absolutely terrified me. It was this very surreal kind of, like, I presume made on a set where everything was padded, and this man was like, and it was all white, and this kind of Mr. Soft was sort of jogging down the road, and the combination of that and the music, I don't know why. I might have to try and make peace with it and watch it after we've done this. I bet it'll be on YouTube, because it absolutely scared the living watsits out of me. I didn't have soft mints for years after that. It really frightened me.
The other big bonus with Make Me Smile is it has the word tarry in it. I can't think of any other song that has the word tarry.
I really can't at all. That is a very idiosyncratic word.
Remembering back to that Cockney Rebel tour that I booked out in 1974, I checked out how much it cost a gig goer to attend, and a stalls ticket at the London Rainbow Theatre was £2 for Cockney Rebel in 1974. And it's interesting to note that the average weekly wage in the UK at that time was £38.10 for men. For women, by the way, £19.70, but that's a whole other story. Don't get us started.
Indeed. No, I've just done the calculation of that, by the way. So that would be 5.25% of your weekly wage. That would be how much that would be.
Right. So 5% of a bloke's weekly wage in 1974.
10% of a woman's weekly wage, I think.
Well, quite. Yes. In 2024, the average weekly wage for men and women in the UK. Hooray.
Stick that in your what's it. Yeah, absolutely.
Is £672. So I looked up how much a stalls ticket would cost for the London Palladium. Barry Manilow next month, £265 for a stalls ticket.
And so I have just done the calculation for that. That is 39.43% of a weekly wage.
So more or less 5% to see a band in London in 74, 40% of a weekly wage in 2024.
Absolutely. Which does that, I mean, you could cut that both ways. Does it show that the live music industry is ridiculously expensive, or does it show that wages have not kept pace with the cost of living? I suspect the latter. Also, just as a general question, how do these venues compare capacity wise? Because the Rainbow in London, I'm just looking this up now to see what the Rainbow in London capacity is. Is 2,802.
I wouldn't think the Palladium is much different, is it? Or is it?
I'm just going to have a look because I've obviously got onto this sort of stats world. I just want to make sure. Yeah, the London Palladium, 2,286.
Not a huge difference.
It's a slightly smaller venue. And yeah, you might pay a bit more to see a band more intimately. But I somehow don't feel, I mean, if you times the sort of, if you're looking at it as the percentage of a wage, it's eight times the proportion of your wage than it would have been in the 70s.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, really?
I
mean, clearly, in terms of, say, the Barry Manilow or any of those gigs where it's £265, only those on really relatively large salaries can go to these sort of gigs in the modern era.
Well, exactly. It rather disenfranchises young people. And you say, oh, young people, you know, some people go, maybe our friend from the Telegraph will go, oh, young people don't like proper music. Yeah, but it's not surprising that young people can only afford to make music in their bedrooms on laptops. That's how it's going to be, isn't it? Young people can't afford to go out. I mean, we could talk forever about the pressure that the live music industry is under at the moment and venues. And I think, you know, that is probably partly the key to this. But yeah, we live in a different world now, for better or for worse.
Well, we do. And also, I mean, no more as I did right through the 1970s, just turn up and buy a ticket at the door. Those days have long gone.
Oh, good.
As I've mentioned before, I did that with David Bowie at the Hammersmith Odeon when he famously closed down Ziggy. We just turned up on the day. Bought a ticket.
It's crazy, isn't it? The fact that everything sells out within seconds now. Although, interestingly, I discovered this 3 hours earlier yesterday, I might have gone. But interestingly, train chaos would have preluded it. But at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, if I'd lived in London, I still could have bought a £20 ticket in the gods to see England versus Sweden women's football at Wembley yesterday. Which I thought was quite interesting. But I agree. The world but I noted that because it was unusual. The world of live music.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the idea that, you know, we saw Suede a few months ago and we had to send someone to queue to get tickets first thing. It's not that world anymore.
Thanks for being with us this week. Good to have you along.
As always, I echo the sentiments of my excellent podcasting co-host and partner.
Steve Harley died last month at only 73. Jules, which track have you chosen to play us out with this week?
Well, surely no one will be shocked that I've picked this, having just talked about it. It's one of those songs that always makes me happy to hear it, no matter what's going on. And I think this is such a tune. It really is. And I was speaking to someone recently who didn't know who he was. And I said the song, she still didn't know. And then I sang it and she joined in. And it's like, yeah, everyone knows this song, I think, really. Steve Harley, Cockney Rebel, called Make Me Smile, brackets, come up and see me, close brackets.
You've done it all. You've broken every code. Paul's the rebel to the floor. You spoke the game, no matter what you say. But only metal, what a there's nothing left, all gone and run away. Maybe you'll tarry for a while. It's just a test, a game for us to play. Win or lose, it's hard to smile.
You've been listening to a Parish Council production.